From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Louis Farabee, the Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. Joining us in studio now is Katie Crystal, the Chair of the Arlington County Board. Katie Crystal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get specifically to Arlington County, Tom Sherwood, let's take a trip through Maryland, where there's an election coming up in November, and there's a governor's race in which the Democrat Wes Moore is going to be competing against the Republican Dan Cox. But it would appear that Wes Moore has become a juggernaut for raising money.
He's raised money across the state, but also around the country. He's really tapping into his work around the nation on a variety of issues. While he only has $1.5 million on hand right now, that's a lot more than the $140,000 that Republican Dan Cox has, and Wes Moore has raised in more than $10 million for his race for governor in Maryland. If you want to contribute to any of the candidates, you can give up to $6,000 if you've got the money sitting around. But it's a significant amount of money. And Dan Cox, who's a hard right candidate that even Republican Governor Larry Hogan didn't want, is having, you know, it's not getting the money. And one good example, maybe the best example of that, is at the Harford County Executive Barry Glassman, who is the Republican candidate for controller of the state, has given $500 to Democrat Wes Moore.
Seeking to distinguish himself from the Republican candidate.
So Barry Glassman is what you would call a traditional Republican, conservative Republican, and he wants no part of what people call the craziness of the very hard right Republican Party.
And this may be the first time I've ever heard you mentioning Dan Cox without quoting Governor Hogan calling him a QAnon whack job.
Well, you know, I started to, but I thought, you know, give it a rest, but thank you, you brought it back.
Had to bring it back. Now, on to Virginia, where Governor Glenn Youngkin was at a rally in Fairfax this week where he was pushing for parents' rights. That's become his mantra. He's also been criticizing trans rules. That has become a mantra for the Republican Party around the country when it comes to education. They're pushing hard against LGBTQ, any kind of literature in schools and the like. And at the same time, books, and there was a lawsuit in Virginia Beach about that was thrown out of court. But Youngkin has also been apparently easing the path, as the Washington Post reports, to becoming a teacher in Virginia.
Yes, the governor won last November in part because of some of the disarray in the school systems like Loudoun County and the battles that were being fought there among candidates, the critical race theory canard that's not taught in the schools, but people thought it was. And this time around, he was at this rally, parents' rally. He's continuing his campaign, and he was saying that parents still should have more say-so individually about what their schools do with their children. And in attacking trans students, he said that biological boys should not play sports with biological girls. So I'm not quite sure why he's taking on this less than 1% of the people in the country who identify as trans, but that's what he's doing because it's been successful. He's traveling around the country campaigning for other candidates, so much so that some Democrats in Virginia this week filed a Freedom of Information request to who's paying for what on these trips. Now, Youngkin's staff says that he's paying for these political trips himself. But the issue about, and on schools, he has an executive order out to make it easier to hire teachers and to do some remedial work for students to catch up after the pandemic. Both of those sound like good things, but the details about how exactly that'll be done, I haven't heard yet.
The devil could be in the details.
I apologize for that long answer, but it's extraordinary how Governor Youngkin has taken education banner and trying to wave it all across the country.
Well, I'm wondering, Katie Crystal, has there been any kind of pushback in Arlington County schools around the LGBTQ issues and whether or not it's being taught, or around critical race theory and whether that's being taught?
You know, the Arlington County Public Schools have a reputation of being inclusive, of caring a lot about kids who come from all parts of the world, all different backgrounds, and in this case, all gender identities. There is not for a second a thought on the part of APS or any of us in county government that we would do anything but resist any sort of state mandate that would run counter to those goals. So it's really disappointing to see the governor engage in this. I think it's cynical. I think it's wrong. I think it's a really devastating departure from a tradition of pretty bipartisan or at least responsible governance in Virginia's statewide elected officials. And we're certainly going to have no part of it in Arlington.
And, you know, children who are either LGBT or trans, you know, if their parents have found out, some of the older, if they're high school students or so, some parents have kicked those children out of, you know, out of their homes. I mean, it's a serious issue. I don't know that the governor, who has suggested that the state keep an individual education plan on every student in the state about what he or she is doing. I'm not quite sure why he wants to do that and take a lot of that information away from local schools. But, you know, just you have to think about the emotional impact on students, whether they're having a girlfriend or boyfriend problems, or whether they're having trouble with math or all these things that teachers and parents and principals should care about. But, you know, they're real human beings, and I think you can't forget that.
That's right. And when you look at the suicide risks among trans youth, for example,
yes,
the consequences are lives at stake to this kind of rhetoric.
I was very involved with my son's, and so was his mother's, growing up, because Peyton had his difficulties. But I always felt like the school was a nurturing place for him that he felt like going to. And if he thought they were just going to tattletale on him day in and day out, that would be very disruptive.
Let's talk about Metro. Yellow and Blue Line trains south of Reagan National Airport will be shut down for 6 weeks beginning September 10th. That'll be followed by an 8-month shutdown of the entire Yellow Line to do work on the Yellow Line Bridge. What alternate transportation will be available to Arlingtonians?
We skateboards.
That's right. Micromobility devices. No, we have a lot of alternative options. And I'll say, too, you know, we are really frustrated at the timing of this, just as people are making decisions in their new commuting habits. Had the opportunity to meet with a new general manager last night and appreciate the degree
to
which
he's
taking
about
it
that.
Seriously. Yeah.
Okay.
So
Randy Clark.
Randy Clark. Jeff McKay, Justin Wilson, my counterparts in Fairfax and Alexandria, and I met with Randy and our two Virginia WMATA board members. And I will say I'm very impressed with his energy. I think he understands the gravity of the moment, and frankly, how little patience the region and riders have with WMATA, and so understands the stakes of getting this right. So one of the first transit alternatives is one I know he's very committed to, which is a shuttle operation, basically, to parallel that route by bus instead. You know, that will kick off with phase one extended to phase two. I know he's planning to be riding it the first commute. I plan to join him in Crystal City on the 12th.
It starts on the 12th of September?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, because the shutdown will start on the 10th.
This is a shutdown of the blue part, the blue line, and the orange line, right? Get all my colors correct.
So blue and yellow is the first
yellow,
phase.
I'm sorry,
yellow
right.
is the second phase, and to be a little parochial about it, it's the latter that we're especially worried about in Arlington. That is a long time for one of our primary rail arteries to be shut down. But as I said, there are alternatives in addition to that shuttle bus. One of the things Arlingtonians may not have traditionally used is the Virginia Railway Express, which does go straight from Crystal City to L'Enfant and Union Station and will be free for the months of September and October. So that's a resource for residents of Arlington, Alexandria in particular. You know, lots of different bus in addition to the bridge. It's a decent time of year to be using Capital Bike Share, if that's an option. The one thing that we need to have more confidence will be an alternative is the blue line. You know, technically the blue line should be an alternative during phase two, but right now those headways render it functionally unusable.
Right.
And so that gets to the importance of getting those 7000 series back online as soon as possible.
You have 11 metro rail stations in Arlington, and it serves the blue, yellow, orange, silver lines. Get all the colors in here. You also have a lot of, like, 20 major bus routes. Are there going to be any additions to the WMATA bus routes? And you also have what's it called, ART, the Arlington Rapid
Transit. Yep, yeah.
Is there any significant change there or what it's going to be doing to try to get people to spaces?
So the major change is, again, that shuttle bus bridge. For riders of the Yellow Line who want to get from their Yellow Line stop to another Yellow Line stop, that shuttle bus is going to be their best option. Right now, it's planning to run consistently during phase one. The tentative plan is for that to be limited to weekday rush hour during phase two. That's something that I'm going to be looking at. I know my colleagues will be too. The idea of rush hour is challenged, to say the least, by how our commuting patterns are changing with working from home and telework, et cetera. And so, you know, that may be an area, if that is successful, we're going to try to push to expand that service.
Some of these things are going on for months. Can I ask a political question before we get to the middle school? Another political question?
It's middle housing.
Middle whatever it is.
Yes,
middle,
okay.
Middle. Oh, well, I'm stuck on schools.
I know.
Another thing about Governor Youngkin. Now, anyway, let me ask you. The President of the United States last night gave a speech and said that Donald Trump and the people on the hard right who are supporting him are threats to democracy. He's even said previously, didn't say last night, that they are semi-fascist. I'm just wondering, you represent Arlington County. I can't think of a more blue space in the state. But some people have criticized the president for making such a dramatic charge against the Republican right and Trump himself. But this is going to be a part of the fall campaign across the nation. What is your own thought? Did the president say just the right thing? Did he go too far? This is one of the most political major things in the country for now to say our democracy is at stake.
I agree with him. First of all, I do think our democracy is at stake, and I think it behooves us to be honest about that. There are very few political or policy priorities that we have that can be achieved in a country that doesn't respect the rule of law. And so this does become a nearly existential question about the future of our democracy and our country. You know, whether the president's words were the perfectly chosen ones, I'll leave it to the pundits to debate. But I will say, recognizing the risk of having a figure in the former president and an enabling party in the Republican Party that does not respect the rule of law and those fundamental principles is a massive threat.
And this comes this week as the one of the defendants in the January 6th riot got a former New York police officer, former Marine, was sentenced to 10 years in prison for physically attacking with a flagpole and other matters, police officers, and ripping gas masks off and all of that. You have a lot of federal facilities in your county, I believe. I think it's the Pentagon in Arlington.
That's a great question. From a geographical perspective,
fight.
Yes. From a governance perspective, no.
It's a big fight.
Yeah.
Yes, but you have a lot of federal facilities. Are you concerned at all about the rising tide of what people, the FBI has said, is domestic violence?
That's, of course we are, not only for the facilities, but the number of Arlingtonians who work in federal agencies right around the region and beyond. There are very real consequences to the type of undemocratic rhetoric. When you talk about things in contexts of war and violence, there are people who listen and will execute that violence. And, you know, I think that comment from the daughter of Guy Reffitt, who was one of the first rioters to be charged, that it was, you know, to her preposterous that her father would be serving so many years in prison when the instigator and organizer of this might be running for president of the United States again, is, to me, really resonates. So we do worry. You know, I think their federal agencies in Arlington have very high standards for safety. But the type of threats on public safety officers in particular and federal agencies are really of great concern to us, a community that is so reflective.
Arlington Police gets involved very quickly because I know Koja has other questions. Are you having the same problem hiring officers as are other jurisdictions?
We have been challenged by recruitment and retention. My colleagues and I voted for a very significant increase to police salaries this year for exactly that reason, and we've worked really closely with representatives of our police department. But it is a challenging profession right now, and to keep our high standards of recruiting people who have college degrees, who really want to make a difference, who are going into this for the right reason to do community policing, that has certainly meant that recruitment has gotten harder.
On to the contentious subject of housing. The county is currently doing a missing middle housing study, an MMHS. Can you remind us what missing middle housing actually means?
Sure. So missing middle housing is the range of house-scale buildings that contain multiple units that are compatible with a single-family neighborhood in scale and height. To give you an example, I live in missing housing or middle housing. I live in a townhouse, part of a row of townhouses surrounded by single-family houses. It's not entirely missing from Arlington. It's just relatively uncommon and largely non-conforming. But it's things like duplexes, small multiplexes, townhouses.
Just to be clear, missing middle housing is not quite the same as affordable housing. Does the county study have anything to do with affordable housing?
That is a great question. So in Arlington, because of the dramatic shortage we're seeing nationally, our region, and locally in housing production, we have an affordability problem, an attainability problem that scales, I would say, from people making 30% of area median income all the way up to people making 150 or more percent of area median income, at least the latter when it comes to ownership. So this is one strategy designed to look at the lack of ownership housing available to people, in that 80 to 100 or 150% area median income. It is not our policy strategy to serve the needs of our low-income neighbors. We have a lot of policy underway and really significant investments of millions of dollars to support that latter group.
This summer, draft framework of the study was shared with Arlington residents for feedback. What have you heard from residents so far about the study?
So folks have been very engaged, which we appreciate. What I would say in brief, you think about Miles' law, where you stand depends on where you sit, to give a pretty specific statistic. We when we collected data on folks' feelings about the question of essentially, should things be excluded from the study? So all the way, are you comfortable basically all the way up to multiplexes with 6 and 8 units? 75% of homeowners said that something should be excluded. They didn't like either the most or all of it. And 77% of renters said include it all. I mean, that is a mirror image. And Arlington is a community that's pretty evenly divided. We're about 60% renters. So it's a study that inspires strong feelings.
If the council votes this, when would it go into effect? And would it do away with single-family zoning and require allowing accessory dwelling units to be built on previous single-family projects? Or will that be affected? That's what most homeowners worry about because they're single-family homeowners and they don't want apartment buildings or accessory buildings built in their neighborhoods.
So first, I would note accessory dwellings are actually legal in Arlington. We've seen a few of those across the county. It's a pretty good analogy for what this study thinks about because it is a policy change that went into effect in all of our low-density neighborhoods. You absolutely will be able to continue to build single-family properties throughout the county. In fact, we anticipate that's probably what the market will continue to do.
But when would this go into effect?
Sure. So we do not yet have a date for when we would vote on any policy changes, but when we do amend our zoning ordinance, it goes into effect more or less immediately. So we want to make sure we've got it right.
This fall or maybe next year? You don't know.
So we haven't set a date. Right now, the phase that we're in, we're proceeding on a couple of tracks. Our staff are drafting legislative language, to use a congressional
term. To implement it.
Exactly. Okay. And the board is engaged in these community dialogues, which we can talk in greater depth about. Those two things are iterative, right? We're feeding
iterative,
the staff.
Yes.
Yeah, what we want staff to incorporate. They're giving us some insights. But we are not going to vote until there's a policy that we feel is, ready and reflects.
And there's one election this fall where they could be affected by this.
Potentially.
Okay.
And you may have answered the question we got from a Twitter account called Arlington Transparency. Will Katie Crystal open missing middle housing discussions to questions and debate?
There's a big brouhaha about whether they've solicited enough advice on this.
Solicited enough input. Sure. So I would say it's very much open to debate right now. What I would say, one of the things we've tried to accommodate is that we know Arlingtonians want to engage in a lot of different forms. Some folks just want to speak their piece to the board and share their opinions that they either really like this or they really don't like this, and it's important that we know that. Some folks want to engage in a more extensive dialogue, and so we're hosting 17 community conversations that we're looking forward to over the next 8 weeks or so, and those are opportunities for board members to listen, but really a neighbor-to-neighbor discussion. Some people just want more information, and so we're hosting some information informational sessions with external experts. So it's not the county talking, but people have some subject matter expertise in zoning and economics to talk about those things. And then, you know, before we vote on any policy changes, we do public hearings and we hear from everyone to speak their 2 to 3 minute piece on their opinion. So I'm very interested if there are other ways people want to engage, but we are working really hard to accommodate all of the different pathways that people might wish to take to give feedback or debate the issue.
On to the phones. Here's Ben in Pentagon City. Ben, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. Thank you. My name's Ben. I have a 3-year-old daughter, so I really think about the missing middle debate in terms of her future, what it's going to look like in 20, 30 years down the road. And I haven't seen a lot of discussion about the long-term implications. And I really worry about climate change and what climate change is going to do, as well as housing affordability in the long term and kind of having that healthy stock of housing that maybe she could afford something when she's older, assuming that our climate hasn't collapsed our country. So I'm really wondering, Chairwoman Crystal, if you could kind of talk about the impact that missing middle could have on climate change, if that's kind of relevant, and especially on like the long-term affordability and availability of housing.
This guy is not even worried about elementary and high school. He's worried about missing middle housing for his daughter.
He's worried about his grandchildren.
That's right. Well, look, as a parent of a 3-year-old myself, I think about the fact what allowed my husband and me to buy into Arlington was a 30-year-old townhouse. And where is the stock of what will be 30-year-old townhouses when Ben's kid or mine is 33, right? So I think that matters a lot. And I'm glad he brought it up because, you know, we've been talking through what the market might likely lead to these different forms being priced at and is it affordable, et cetera. But that's new construction, right? You know, that proverb that the best time to plant a tree is today, the second best time is 30 years ago. So what are we planting that is going to be affordable and be that modestly priced housing stock 30 years from now? The climate piece is an excellent one. One of the earliest supporters of the Missing Middle Framework was the Sierra Club, quickly followed by the Faith Alliance for Climate Justice. You know, drive till you qualify, which has historically been a lot of regions' approaches to attainable housing or ownership housing, is devastating for our environment. You know, people doing those long-haul commutes are terrible for our air quality and for greenhouse gas emissions. You know, all of Arlington, generally speaking, is a transit-rich and job opportunity-rich area, and so allowing people to live close to.
But no streetcar.
No streetcars, sir.
Do you have another?
Yes, one more. Jane in Arlington, your turn. Jane, go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Katie already mentioned that from the initial phase of community feedback, about 77% of renters support missing middle housing, and renters are 60% of Arlington residents, but we know that they are vastly underrepresented in Arlington's community engagement. How are you trying to address this? And I say this as a proud renter.
Thank you for bringing that up. This is absolutely a challenge that we have in the community, and it's really only gotten more acute as the percent of Arlington residents who are renters has grown over the last decade or two. We are trying to meet people where they are, which is what everybody always says on engagement. And for the missing middle, what that has meant is doing pop-ups, for example, in places like Bike to Work Day, or increasingly in places where we know maybe our Spanish language speaking population is likelier to congregate. We've tried to translate a lot of these materials, those community conversations, as I mentioned. Two of them will be Spanish language only. Not that all of our renters speak Spanish or vice versa, but those are populations that are likely to overlap, just as a couple of examples.
Before we run out of time, Amazon. There was a big story in the Post. The headline suggested Arlington was reneging on paying Amazon, but you read the story, it just sounds like the revenues that you had promised to use have not come in because of COVID. How is the Amazon-Arlington partnership going now? I go over there and I see a lot of building.
Yeah, I think it's been really strong. And actually, you know, we don't cheer the fact that our hotel tax has cratered, for example, but that was part of what the incentive deal was structured on.
Yeah,
they would only
benefit
if we benefited.
Folks who don't know, you used to get $25 million a year in hotel revenues. Now you're down to around $5 million, and part of the payment to Amazon is based on those revenues.
That's exactly right. Okay. I mean, I remember talking to you guys in 2018 and saying the deal is that Amazon doesn't benefit unless Arlington benefits. And so none of us anticipated the pandemic, but that's exactly how it's paid out.
But Arlington's on track. I mean, Amazon's on track with its construction.
Absolutely.
Million square feet and all that other stuff.
Right. And so notwithstanding the incentive deals, we've been really pleased with the partnership and glad to have them as a corporate citizen in Arlington.
In the 30 seconds or so we have left, the Arlington County School Board removed school resources officers from schools last year. Is that something that that restarting that program is something that you would consider?
So our public schools have been in pretty close contact with the Arlington County Police Department, and the county board has supported the police department in reimagining what that partnership looks like to keep schools safe, absent the physical officers in schools, and that's probably what we'll continue to work on.
Katie Crystal is the chair of the Arlington County Board. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming in.
Next up, Lewis Furby, Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Lewis Furby, the Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. Chancellor Furby, thank you very much for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Before we get to D.C. Public Schools, Tom Sherwood, the Hyattsville mayor who died by suicide earlier this year, Kevin Ward, was considered by many people a role model for a variety of things, but especially for inclusion. He was an African-American, he was openly gay, and his death by suicide took a lot of people by surprise, and there was a lot of mourning about him. But the role model image may be rapidly disappearing because he's now being accused by the Justice Department of having embezzled $2.2 million from KIPP DC. KIPP DC, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is the largest charter school operator in the district. And of course, charter schools, like district public schools, get taxpayer funds.
Highly respected KIPP school system. I think the chancellor would agree with that. This is unfortunate because, first of all, suicide is a terrible thing. And this former mayor did, in fact, kill himself. And now we've learned that maybe he's being accused by the U.S. Justice Department of stealing something like $2.2 million from the KIPP organization. He was the senior director of technology for 8 campuses in the district. It wasn't a small deal. And he created a network of front companies in order to siphon this money. So it's tragic that he died and that he killed himself. It's tragic for the schools that lose this money because they can use every dime they possibly can get to educate the kids in the District of Columbia.
It's a tragedy all the way around. D.C. Attorney General is suing a billionaire for not paying his D.C. taxes. The billionaire is Michael Saylor, and he says that he lives actually in Virginia. He's the head
in Florida.
In Florida. He is the CEO and and founder of MicroStrategy, which is in Virginia. But Saylor says he lives in Florida, that he votes in Florida, that he does jury duty in Florida. But the Attorney General of D.C. says, look, we looked at all of your social media, and you definitely seem to be giving the impression that you live here and this is your home.
Yes, the Attorney General, Carl Racine, is into his final months of being the Attorney General because he didn't run for re-election, but is certainly not taking his foot off the gas. And in this case, he says all that Michael Saylor stuff about serving in Florida and living in Florida is a sham and a scam, that he, in fact, since 2005, has been in the District of Columbia in Georgetown and on a yacht here and some other things, and simply has not paid taxes and income taxes. And a billionaire, I think he's a billionaire. Mm-hmm. I think the estimate was he has avoided something like $25 million in taxes that he should have been paying here. And so the Attorney General is suing him. Now, if the Attorney General wins, there is a provision for what they call treble damages. And the award to the city could be as much as $75 million. I don't know if we'll get to that or not. Maybe they'll have some negotiated settlement. But it's not unusual, whether you're a poor person or a super wealthy person, to scam the District of Columbia by living here and not paying taxes, by not registering your car, by claiming some other place where you might be from, because like Florida, where there are no income taxes. It's a real problem for the Office of Tax and Revenue of the district that so many people here, however many thousands there might be, who simply don't pay for living in the district.
And one remembers what the late hotel magnate Leona Helmsley once said, we don't pay taxes, only the little people pay taxes. So we'll have to see about that. We did mention the death by suicide of the former mayor of Hyattsville. I should give out the information for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It is now easy, simple. It's just 988. For texting, the crisis text line is a texting service for emotional crisis support. You can text HELLO to 74174. Now on to the D.C. Public Schools, Chancellor Lewis Ferbey. Chancellor Ferbey, D.C. students returned to school on Monday. The district required a test to return policy before students returned to the classroom. How did that work out? Did DCPS receive a negative COVID test from every student who entered each school?
Yeah, thank you for that question. We're excited to welcome students back this week. It's been a special week for us. We have received many students back on campus. We got our kindergarten and 12th graders through 12th graders on a Monday, and then we got our pre-K students on yesterday. We're excited to have our 3-year-old, 4-year-olds back. I just left Phelps Academy. Great for me to see our HVAC programs, our electricity programs. So it's great to know that we've got future employers here looking at our students as a part of the workforce. What I would say in terms of our COVID protocols is that we know that our families are familiar with all of these protocols. It has been a seamless process for people to upload their results. And we had over 35,000 young people have them or their families upload their results on the first day. And we had over 3,000 of our pre-K students upload their results. We do have the capability to test students on site. So we did test thousands of students on site. And I am not aware and can't report any scenario where we excluded the students. So,
what are the results of those tests? Have you found many infections?
We have found minimal cases of positive individuals of COVID-19. We had about 100 positive in the last count that I've seen. But, of course, that's a fluid number as we progress through the week. But I do think that represents, you know, a small number of individuals that have tested positive.
Chancellor Ferbey, this is Tom Sherwood, just to be clear for you to know. What is the current mask mandate for public schools now for employees and for students?
Yes, so the Office of State Superintendent Education and DC Health collaborate on all of the protocols and guidelines for mitigating transmission of COVID in our schools. And last year, we transitioned to a mask optional posture, and we are in that posture for this current school year as well. And we have a strong campaign to ensure that anyone that desires to wear a mask, that they do so without any
ridicule
or a bullied or teasing. And we haven't seen or heard much of that happening in our schools. And again, most people are familiar with the protocols that we had last year.
Let me ask one quick question. Montgomery County schools, public schools in the suburbs, are going to limit cell phone use in the schools. The students who bring cell phones to the schools have to put them in their locker in the morning and then take them out in the afternoon. There are some exceptions if some older students in the high school area, if the teachers want them to use them at lunchtime or the principals agree to that, or special needs students. But overall, what is the cell phone use policy for D.C. public schools?
Chancellor Ferbey? We seem to have temporarily lost Chancellor Ferbey.
Maybe got another call.
Another call came through, but there are a lot of people who would like to talk to him. We've gotten a number of tweets, but if you'd like to call, the number is 800-433-8850. You can send an email to kojo@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet at Politics Hour. You can reach us on Facebook at The Politics Hour. We're waiting for Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools, Lewis Ferbey, to rejoin us and respond to the question that Tom is asking. One of the things we can talk about with the Chancellor at some point is whether there's been the same kind of pushback about books and teaching in the District of Columbia that there has been in Virginia. Of course, D.C. is such a blue district that I would expect that the pushback has not been as much, but I haven't seen any of it at all having to do with whether or not LGBTQ issues are being taught or discussed in school, whether or not so-called critical race theory, which is not taught in schools, is allegedly being taught in schools. I haven't seen any of that.
Well, no, in the District of Columbia, you know, we have a substantial library system and the school system and books. In fact, Council Member Charles Allen started that program where you can sign up and have books sent to your home. I think monthly you get a book for children 5 or so years old. I don't know the exact program. But it, fortunately for the District of Columbia, book burning and book banning has not been a significant issue here.
Well, Chancellor Farabee is back. I think you had asked him a question before we went.
Yeah, ask about the, just briefly, what this, it mentioned that Montgomery County Schools is getting more tough or a little tougher about cell phone use in the schools. What is the policy in the district? Do can students in junior and high school have phones? What is the policy?
There is no district-wide policy for DC public schools on cell phone use in the building and throughout the day. Schools take a number of different approaches based on their specific context. So we do have schools where there are lockers for cell phones that they hold throughout the day. Some schools utilize the technology of cell phones throughout the day as a part of the learning experience. And sometimes as a part of the experience on campus, students are asked to limit cell phone use. So it does vary. We lean to our school leaders to make those decisions on what's best for students.
I assume they have to put the phones. I assume they have to put the phones away when they're doing a test, and they can't Google an answer, which is what I would do.
Yeah. So we do have a policy on integrity of assignments, testing, to ensure that there is, you know, no cheating or anything that would compromise the integrity of the results that students are completing their assignments or homework.
Before Kojo gets to official issues, can I get some quick politics?
I got to do some quick COVID because we haven't gotten past that yet. And a lot of people have been.
Can just a quick policy question?
Sure.
Do you support the end of mayoral control of schools, and do you want an independent school education committee or the council when it reforms or recommits itself in January? Mayor control and an independent education committee on the council.
Yeah, I mean, I think the current structure we have, from my vantage point, has served me and our team well in ability to quickly respond to the needs of our families. And I believe that there's a history that we can point to that, you know, this structure works for our families, and we've seen tremendous results accordingly over the last years or so. So
yeah, you've been the chancellor for 4 years. December will be your fourth anniversary. So you want mayor control to continue. What about a council in a standalone education committee? That's a big issue within the council itself right now.
Yeah, I haven't been tracking that concept well enough to speak on it, so I don't have much to offer there. But again, I would say that I think there's a lot that we could point to that represents the benefits of the current structure we're in, specifically for D.C. And I think our ability to be agile and mobile is critical, especially in the era we're in where there's a critical response to some of the impacts of the pandemic.
One last quick political question. The mayor would like to see the council cut out and is phasing out school resource officers. You testified that you would like to keep them. Do you still agree with the mayor that school resource officers have a role to play and they should be put back?
I completely disagree with this approach of phasing out school resource officers. I have not talk with a staff member or a parent who is in alignment with that approach. I believe our school resource officers have worked hard to foster strong relationships with our students and our families, and they're just not perceived to be as a threat, and they're perceived to be a resource and a value add. And I worry that when we do have the need to have law enforcement respond to a school, the people in that building won't know the person that's responding in the same way they know our school resource officers. And in law enforcement, in those interactions, relationships matter.
Our guest is Lewis Farabee.
It's important to have that presence.
Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. Here's Denise in Northwest D.C. Denise, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. Good afternoon. My question is sort of a public health, COVID and other transmittable diseases concern. I understand that water fountains are back up and operating at DC public schools, and that seems like such a great way to very quickly spread COVID and other diseases among children, especially young kids who we know are just, you know, straight up licking those water fountains. They don't quite know how to use them. I'm calling to ask to please have those, you know, either kind of removed would be ideal, but if not, just covered up and put out of use, especially as we enter flu season, winter. I mean, it's just such a good way to spread disease among our children. You know, maybe we can have one of those devices where kids can refill their water bottles instead, but water fountains are just such a nightmare.
Chancellor Farabee.
Yeah, so we follow the guidance of the CDC and also the Department of Health for the District of Columbia. We have not received any guidance that water fountains are contributing to the transmission of COVID in schools or other viruses or disease. So we believe that that option should be available to students who desire to have water through a water fountain. But as the caller mentioned, you can bring water bottles in many cases to school, and if students want to rely on, you know, their own sources of water, they certainly can do so. And then there are water stations in some of our schools in addition to water fountains.
Wendy tweeted, what did Chancellor Farabee learn from the insane COVID spike last year that happened a week before Christmas, and what will he do differently this year?
Well, I think our important learning all throughout the process of responding to COVID is, as I mentioned earlier, the ability to be agile and nimble and to move quickly when we need to make adjustments to operations. And we've made a number of refinements throughout the process. You know, we started test the return, I just talked about earlier last year, which can be helpful when we have long breaks. We also have a number of other strategies that we've implemented and we'll continue to implement, but we'll also adjust as needed. So I think that's the important learning from all of this is to, you know, evolve as the situation evolves and to continue to collaborate with the health experts to ensure that we have the best intel information to be responsive.
DC schools are requiring eligible students to get the COVID-19 vaccine, but the school system is delaying enforcement of that until January. Why is that?
Well, first, I want to say how important all of our childhood immunizations are, and you know, the pediatric immunizations are a priority right now. And so we focused on those for this time period to ensure that all of our students are in compliance. We have a number of different options for families to have access to those vaccines. And, you know, the council established last year legislation around the COVID-19 vaccine that be required for students 12 and older. Now, while we do certainly recognize the importance of the COVID-19 vaccine to help mitigate transmission of the virus, and also we know that in many cases, your symptoms can be much milder. But we right now want to ensure that we are paying attention to the basics. We prioritize those in terms of our pediatric immunization. That includes things like measles, mumps, polio, all the things that are important.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because more than a quarter of DC students are out of compliance with their routine childhood vaccinations. Some schools have much larger rates of non-compliance, but what is DCPS doing to help students at those schools get up to date?
Yeah, that number is moving, and it's moving because, one, as I said earlier, we've expanded access. Secondly, we've given families a lot more information to understand what's required for the age of their child, and also how to best connect with the healthcare providers in our community to quickly get appointments and to get shots in arms. So we anticipate those numbers will continue to move. And we're being more aggressive this year with the compliance of all the childhood routine immunizations that are needed for school.
Chancellor, I think everyone would agree that our young children, when they enter school, are bright and are like sponges to soak up information when they first go to school. But you know, by the time they get to the fourth grade, external factors and other factors waylay many of them, and they hopelessly fall behind in reading and math. And the usual summer slide and COVID have added to that. The New York Times reported this week that the National Assessment of Education Progress, which is a federal agency, reported that students in general lost 2 years of education despite the off-site learning and the efforts to catch up. Why isn't there some type of Marshall Plan to get the whole school system, whether, no matter what the teacher is, biology or education or math, why isn't there a Marshall Plan to catch children back up with reading and math skills?
Yeah, I have a lot of confidence in our plan. In fact, there's some data points that we have from last school year that represents the promise of our plan. For example, when we assessed our students on early literacy skills, which is the foundation, right? So we know if we get the early literacy skills in place, students have the prerequisite skills to read and comprehend well, which supports all content areas, including math, science, social studies, and the like. And what we saw is marked improvement in performance. In fact, we saw a 25% point gain in students reading or having the skills on grade level in our earliest grade levels. And that's important. It's important because we haven't seen those types of gains in a very long time. And it exceeds where we've been in previous years in terms of ground covered. But also, it almost put us really close to pre-pandemic levels of proficiency. And so we believe that we continue down that path, we will see strong acceleration of learning, which
Gotta
is what we
talk
expect.
About school buildings. D.C. Department of General Services is tasked with making sure school buildings are up to date. DGS Director Keith Anderson said that no outstanding work orders were preventing schools from reopening, but according to the DGS HVAC dashboard, there are more than 660 work orders to fix HVAC systems across more than 100 schools, issues with ACs not working, dilapidated school conditions. We've been hearing about this for years. What are you doing to address this issue?
Well, I want to go back to where I started. Is I was so impressed today at Phelps Academy with the HVAC class. And so I'm excited that we got young people earning their credentials to be in our community and to be the next generation of HVAC professionals. So I would give them another shout out. But yes, we have been preparing all summer for the opening of this school year. There hasn't been any operational barriers that have prevented us from opening school and inviting students and staff back into our buildings. Now, are there work orders that need to be addressed? Absolutely. There will be work orders throughout the year that we will address, and we have a system to prioritize certain work orders, and HVAC is one of those areas, along with fire, life, and safety.
Excuse me, Chancellor, I appreciate that, but we're almost
exactly
out of
a minute
town.
And a half.
I know,
left.
We're almost out of time. From the D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson to the at-large Council Member Robert White, who oversees DGS, excuse me, which does the school work, to individual school council members, to individual parents, to individual schools. Everyone is complaining that, yes, you've done this agency has done a great deal of work, but not nearly as much as it should have done. That seems to be the issue.
Yeah, I disagree. I believe that, you know, there's always going to be opportunities to improve your facilities, as it is with your home. And most people, when they finish a project, there's another project that they want to do immediately following that. And it's going to be a similar process with our facilities. Now, what we have done, which, again, I think is the right approach, is to have priorities. And when you have priorities, that means that some work orders will become more important than others as you think about the sequence of how you address
them. The
city we're just about out of time, and ultimately schools. I'm assuming you're going to say you're going to get to it all, but that is for a future discussion with Louis Farabee, Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Tom Sherwood, I know you have big plans this weekend, and it has to do with books.
Yes, the National Book Festival is back at the Washington Convention Center. It's going to be great. And on next Thursday, I'm doing the first big debate between the at-large candidates for the council.
You got a busy week up ahead, so try to get it all done. And for the rest of you, have a great holiday weekend and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nambi.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer this week is Martin Ostermuhl. Kellen Quigley is our engineer, and our broadcast engineer today is Kenny Pierog. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Tom Hudson oversees all the content we make at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.